Dear Sangha, today is June 8, 2000, and we are in the New Hamlet. Today is the first of the second week, first day of the second week in our 21-day retreat. I think the expression super organism is given by a person whose name is Wheeler, describe the community of these social insects as one organism where harmony exists. When we recite Three Refuges, we also say that I take refuge in the Sangha, in the community of harmony, that lives in harmony and awareness. So harmony is should be the characteristic of a real Sangha. But in the beehive, there is also harmony. The difference between a Sangha and a beehive is that we have awareness. So if we call the Sangha harmony organism, it will not differ very much from the organization of the bees, and maybe we can call it awareness organism or something, awareness organism, mindful organism. Because it is the practice of mindfulness that makes a Sangha into a real Sangha. And if we have harmony and happiness and solidity, that is because we know how to practice mindfulness. Mindfulness is the heart of the Buddhist practice. Because mindfulness brings concentration and insight. And that insight has the power to liberate us, to transform us, and to make us live in harmony and happiness. We can use the word conscious. Conscious organism. Also, we should find out the appropriate word in order to express the idea, the notion that Sangha is a community that practice mindfulness in order to be together in harmony, in solidity, in happiness, and offering herself as a refuge to many living beings. Three million and a half years ago, humans were able to stand up and not to walk on the two hands anymore. And the race of Homo erectus began to manifest. And since that day, our brain has been able to grow very quickly because our hands are liberated from the task of walking. That is why we become very free. And we begin to use our hands in order to manipulate many instruments, And the way we make use of our hands can have a very deep effect on our brain. And since that time, our brain has grown three times bigger than before. We have learned to think, to express ourselves in languages. And grammar, syntax, metaphors, all of that have been born just because we were able to stand up and to get our arm, our hand free. So the environment can have an impact, very important impact on our biological nature. Homo erectus, Homo sapiens. But the Buddha belonged to that species of humans that can be called Homo conscious, the mindful person, the mindful human being. Homo conscious is the human that is aware of what is going on in his mind, in his action, and in his speech. If only we know, we become aware of what is going on in these three domains, and then we would be able to avoid a lot of mistakes. If I'm saying something mean to you, and if I am aware that I'm doing that, and then I stop saying things that can make you suffer and me suffer also, that is the power of mindfulness. If I am acting cruelly, destroying my fellow human beings, and if I am aware of that, I have a chance to stop. If you are thinking wrongly, and if I know that I am thinking wrongly in the wrong direction, and then I would be able to stop that way of thinking. And that is the power of mindfulness. So when we practice mindfulness, we belong to that race of humans that take mindfulness as our art of daily living. And when we live as a Sangha, and the Sangha become the kind of organism, our own body, with which we move, we think, and we act. And when we come together as a Sangha, we are no longer individuals, and something happened. Something happened. We become stronger, and we know better what to do and not what to do. We know the most important thing to do, or the best way to be. There's a scientist whose name is Grasse. He studied the life of the termites, and he invented the word stick merge. Very interesting term. In order to describe the way the social insect behave, Stick here means to the act of insect biting. Peculiar insect incitation. And noji means the work. In French, herb. Motivating your motivation to be there, and your inspiration that you get in order to work, to be active, is the work itself. Suddenly you know what you want to do, and you do together. According to many, when the social insects, they come together and reach the community size, the sangha size, they begin to be transformed. They become an organism, a real organism. And they communicate, they release pheromones, and suddenly become active. That is one of the aspects of their life, coming together, and when reaching the community size, there's a transformation, there's a big inspiration, there's life as an organism. And the second thing is that when they look into the situation, they see that there are things that have been done. Like when they build a column, and it is by looking at the work that is half done that they get the inspiration to act, to live. And that is why it is said that it is the work that inspire the individuals of the community to get going and to do things together. It looks like there is awareness that there is something that you can do for your own well-being and for the well-being of the whole community. And that is the second thing that happened when members of the Sangha come together and reach the Sangha size. Before that, we did not know what to do. We were not inspired. But when we come together as Sangha, and suddenly you realize that there are things to do, and we enjoy doing that together. So the incitation to get going on, to do things, to realize, to build, just because you realize that the work is there to be done. I learned that the pigeons, they do not lay egg if they don't see other pigeons around. If a pigeon is left alone, she will not lay eggs. Only when she sees other pigeons flying around, and that she begin to lay eggs. And the termites, they act very much the same thing. If they are to rebuild the chamber of the termite queen, they should see the termite queen there in order to begin things. when they see the queen, they suddenly become aware that there is something to do, and they begin to build the chamber for the queen right away. Otherwise, they would go around, they don't do anything. So it is the work that inspires the action and the life together as a Sangha. It's very much the same thing when the Sangha is convened. When the Sangha is convened, the Sangha reaches the size that can give her the inspiration, the energy. And as the Sangha come together, there is an awareness of the suffering, of something to be done in order to transform, to heal. The awareness of the first noble truth, dukkha, ill being, become real. And inspired by the desire to do something in order to reduce the amount of suffering that is there, will inspire us to live in such a way and to practice in such a way and to be active in such a way that the suffering could be understood, suffering could be identified, suffering could be relieved, and well-being become a reality. It is our task as a Sangha to recognize that suffering is there. It is our task as a Sangha to look deeply into the nature of our suffering in order to see the way out of suffering, the way of cessation. And as separate individuals, we do not have enough inspiration, energy, in order to do that. But when we come together as a Sangha, there is the vitality, the strength, the awareness that help us to do that. That is why the coming together of individuals to become a Sangha, it is a very important event in our life. The other day we spoke about the Sangha eyes. And we may have the tendency to think of the Sangha eyes as the eyes of the community. And the community have to come together as a group and begin to look. And at that moment we have the Sangha eyes. And we think that the Sangha eyes is not our individual eyes, but we do have our Sangha eyes, every one of us. The Sangha eyes is your eyes. But you use your eyes in such a way that you can see what the Sangha can see. You don't need everyone of the Sangha to be there in order to have the Sangha eyes. Because as member of a community of practice, you learn to walk with the Sangha feet. You learn how to act with Sangha arm, and you learn to look with the Sangha eyes. So learning to look with the Sangha eyes is our practice. You look not as an individual, but you look as a community, a Sangha. And suddenly your Sangha eyes reveal itself to you. You do have the Sangha eyes. You have to make use of your Sangha eyes. You do have the Buddha eyes. You have to make use of your Buddha eyes. You have your Dharma eyes. You have to make use of your Dharma eyes. If you find yourself physically alone in a marketplace or in another city, but if you still practice taking refuge in Sangha, and then it is the Sangha who is there in the marketplace, in the faraway city, and you can walk, you still can walk with the feet of the Sangha, you can still look with the Sangha eyes and listen with the Sangha ears. Therefore, you have to remember the Buddha eyes is not the eyes of someone called Buddha alone. The Sangha eyes is the eyes that we possess. But our practice is to cleanse it, to help it manifest so that we can make use of our Buddha eyes. The eyes of the Buddha, it means our Buddha eyes. And the teaching of Mahayana Buddhism is that you are a Buddha. You are a potential Buddha. You have the nature of awakening. You have the capacity of complete enlightenment. You have the capacity of great love and great freedom. And your practice is to allow that great love, that great freedom to manifest. Your practice is allow the Buddha eyes in you to reveal fully so that you can look as a Buddha. The Buddha has six kind of eyes. Fleshly eyes, heavenly eyes, Dharma eyes, wisdom eyes, Sangha eyes, Buddha eyes. Each of us also has six kind of eyes. We have our fleshly eyes, we have our heavenly eyes, we have our Dharma eyes, we have our wisdom eyes, we have our Sangha eyes, and we do have our Buddha eyes. And therefore our practice is to allow these six eyes to manifest fully, to be cleansed thoroughly, so that we can observe the world, we can see the world. You might like to inquire about the characteristics of our Buddha eyes. The Buddha eyes is a kind of eyes. They can help us see things in their true nature, in their suchness. Suchness is a technical term, Buddhist technical term, it means reality as it is. Chân như suchness. Incité. Reality is reality. It could not be expressed in notions, in concepts. The only thing you can say about reality is that reality is reality. And your attempt to describe reality always fail. There is only one way to understand reality, to have a direct access. And that direct access to reality is possible only when you have freedom. And especially freedom from notions and ideas, prejudices and so on. Suppose we talk about durian as a fruit. Many of you do not know that fruit. There's so many people who are crazy about durian. They love it so much, it's so expensive. And there are many people who love that kind of fruit so much that after having eaten it, they keep the skin and they put it under their bed in order to continue to smell that. But for many of us, it's a horrible kind of smell. In countries of Southeast Asia, especially in Cambodia, they grow a lot of that kind of fruit, durian. And I remember when I was a young monk, and I was reciting the Lotus Sutra, and I could not concentrate at all on the sutra because on the altar someone has offered to the Buddha a durian. Before that, I had been offered a piece of durian, and I thought it was jackfruit, so I put it in my mouth. But after I had done that, I was caught, because it was a formal meal. I could not swallow, and I could not spit it out. I suffered so much. So I got a strong internal formation concerning durian. So that day I was reciting one chapter of the Lotus Sutra. Suddenly I hear, I smell, and I look up and I saw the durian. I couldn't concentrate, but I got to finish the recitation. So I look around and I didn't see any escape. So finally I stood up, I used the bowl bell, and I imprisoned the food inside. And I recited the sutra without using the bell, only the drum. And after I finished the recitation, I liberated the durian. I like to tell the story about the durian in order to make people understand that when you love someone, you should understand him or her and not offer him and her things that she could not enjoy. If someone say that, hey, you work so hard, you need something good to eat, you have to eat this durian, and then I will suffer a lot. So be aware that your beloved one, you have to understand him deeply, what she likes, what she dislikes, and don't offer the things that will make her suffer. Understanding is the base of love. If you lack understanding, and then out of goodwill, you want to make him happy, to make her happy, but in fact, you are making him suffer a lot. Then some of us here have had direct experiences about durian, like myself. Now suppose someone who come and ask you, tell me about the durian. How does it taste like? And it would be very difficult. Even if I have had direct and real contact with durians, I could not tell you how it tastes. The language that I possess is useless. I cannot use the language in order to make you to give you a notion about durian. Durian is reality, and reality cannot be expressed by words and concepts. Durian or bananas. If someone has not tasted bananas, if someone has not tasted guava or mango, and you try your best, even if you try your best, you cannot convey to him or to her the reality of the taste of a mango. That is the situation. Reality is like that. Reality cannot be described by words and notions and concepts. The only way to help the other person to know what is a real taste of the mango is to put a piece of mango into his mouth. So direct experience only can help you to understand reality as it is, and not reality as a notion, as a concept. So the Buddha eyes is the kind of eyes that give you access to reality in itself. And you should be free from all preconceived ideas and notions in order to have that direct access. Therefore, the Buddha eyes is characterized by freedom. Freedom from views, freedom from concepts. Doctrines, ideologies, theories are considered to be views. And in Buddhism, the word drishti, dithi, means views. And according to the Buddha eyes, all views are wrong views. Dithi, that is the Pali word, drishti, the Sanskrit word, it means views. It only means views, but when it goes like that, it stands like that alone, it means wrong views. All views are wrong views. The right view is the absence of views. Because you don't have views, you just have the reality. You don't have any view anymore. And that is the Buddhist teaching about ultimate reality. You can say something about God. You can have several ideas about God. You can offer the logics and the speech about God, theology. But nothing, no idea, no concepts, no words can describe that reality called God. We cannot say anything about God. God is to be experimented directly. And in Buddhism, suchness is the word that we use in order to denote, to call that ultimate reality. They cannot be described with words and notions and concepts. Such means, well, banana is banana. Durian is durian. You cannot say anything about it. It is what it is. Entity, suchness. That's the maximum you can do. And the Buddha eyes is the kind of eyes that can help us to have direct access to the ultimate reality. And you can do that only when you are liberated from all views. This is a sutra that you have in front of you. It's a text. Discourse on the Absolute Truth. Let us read together to get a kind of taste. He who still abides by dogmatic
He does not consider himself as superior in
This sutra is translated from the Pali canon. Belong to a collection of sutras called Sutta Nipata. And the name of the sutra, the title of the sutra is Paramattaka Sutta. Paramatta means the absolute truth, the higher truth. In Buddhism, we distinguish two kinds of truth, the absolute truth and the relative truth. The relative truth is called Samvritti Satya, and the absolute truth is called Paramatta Satya. When you study Buddhist literature, the sutras, you have to bear in mind that sometimes the relative truth is being offered to you. The absolute truth will be is being offered to you. You have to distinguish that. Because sometimes what the Buddha said seems to contradict each other. Sometimes he said that you are of the nature to die. You cannot escape death. But sometimes he also said that, well, the reality, the ultimate reality is not affected by birth and death. There is no birth, there is no death. Say that you have to use your Dhamma eyes. Sometimes he said that there is no eyes. Like in the Heart Sutra, no eyes, no ear, no nose. So things he said seem to be contradicting each other. And if you see that contradiction, and if you don't mind, it is because you already know the truth about two kinds of truth. It's like to say that while we sit here, we realize that this is the direction of our abode, and here is the direction of our below. We are very sure that this is above, this is below. But just visualize our friends in China who are sitting on the other side of the planet. They wouldn't agree that this is their abode. They would believe this is their below. So when we speak of above and below, we speak in terms of relative truth. Because the idea of below and above cannot be applied to the cosmos. Suppose this is the globe, the earth. And this is Paris, and this is New York. And you are taking the plane here, and you think you are going this way. But if you go this way, you never got to New York. You have to go this way. And you go this way is the way to go back to Paris also, because if you continue and then you go back to Paris, you think that you are leaving Paris for good, but you are going back to it all the time. So there are different ways of seeing the same thing. And you should know that it is the relative truth that you are speaking about, or the absolute truth. And this is very important for understanding the Buddha's teaching. And this sutra is about the absolute truth, paramartha. And we learn right away that the absolute truth is the kind of truth that cannot be contained that cannot be grasped by ideas, notions, and words. This sutra is very old, very archaic. It belongs to the series of sutras that are the most ancient in the Buddhist literature. In a collection of sutra called Sutta Nipata, there are two chapters that have been considered by many, many scholars as the most ancient scriptures of Buddhism. And these two chapters are Mahavagga and Arthavagga. And our sutra belong to the chapter Arthavagga. In Pali, Arthavagga. When you study the Pali text, you realize that the wording, the syntax, the grammar, bear the characteristic of the Vedic and Brahmanistic literature that could not be seen in later Buddhist literature, in other sutras. And that is why philologists all agree with each other that this is the most archaic kind of scriptures that are available to us. It reflects the teaching of Buddha in its first stage, when the Sangha was not organized to live in monastery. Bhikshus were still wandering around. There was no monastery. And the sutra reveals that there were a lot of philosophical speculations in his time. I have been able to find the equivalent in the Chinese canon of this sutra. It was translated in the beginning of the 3rd century. By a lay person whose name is Jikim. Jikim. And the collection of sutra he translated here bear the name of Nghĩa Túc Kinh. Nghĩa Túc Kinh. That means the meaning, tuk means sufficient, everything is there, and not lacking anything. Kin means sutra. If you know something about the history of Vietnamese Buddhism, you would know that during the first half of the 3rd century, there was a Vietnamese Buddhist monk whose name is Tăng Hồi, who went to teach Buddhism in China. At that time, China was divided into three countries after the dissolution of the Han regime. And that period of time is called the period of the Three Kingdoms, Tam Quốc. The northern state is called Bắc Ngụy. The kingdom on the west side is Tây Thục. And the country below the Yangtze River is called Đông Ngô. And when Master Tăng Hồi arrived in the capital of Đông Ngô, it is said that there was no Buddhism, there's no Buddhist monks in the kingdom of Vu. And the monk Tăng Hồi was the first Buddhist monk to appear in the kingdom of Vu, Tăng Hồi. Tăng Hồi's father had come to Vietnam by boat as a merchant and a tradesman. As a young man, he found the country appealing to him, so he stayed there. He married a Vietnamese woman, and he gave birth to that boy, who became later a very famous monk. And Tăng Hồi became a novice monk at the age of 11 or 12, a baby monk. And in the temple, he studied Sanskrit and Chinese, and he had translated many sutras from Sanskrit to Chinese. And he had wrote the foreword for the sutra on the practice of mindful breathing in and out. And that is still available in the Chinese canon. So after having studied, practiced, and taught in Vietnam, he left the country to go and to bring the Dharma to China. And in the records of the life of eminent monks in China, it is said that when Tăng Hồi came, there was no monk, Chinese monk at all. He was the first Buddhist monk to be seen by the Chinese people. And he was able to help and to convince the king of the Ngô to receive the 5 mindfulness training. And the king built for him a practice center, the first Buddhist practice center in the kingdom, called the Kiến Sơ Tự, the first built Buddhist temple in the country. And later on, he sent forth other monks from Vietnam and organized ordination ceremonies for Chinese Buddhist monks. But when he arrived, although there was no Chinese monks or foreign monks there, but there was a scholar who came from India, whose name is Chi Khiêm. And this monk is a great scholar. He knows so many languages. And he had brought with him a number of manuscripts. And he came from a country called Indo-Scythia. At about the end of the first century AD, the kingdom of Scythia included also Kashmir, very big. And King Kanishka, ruling over the kingdom, was a great protector of Buddhism. So Chikhim came from that kingdom with a lot of scriptures with him. A real Buddhist, a lay person, Upasaka. And he arrived in China during the Han Dynasty, but there was war, the country was divided, and then he had to go south. And because he was so good in language, in philosophy, that is why King Ngô Tôn Quyền asked him to be the preceptor, the teacher of the prince. The prince has two teachers, and Chikhim was one of them. And it was Chikhim who translated this collection of sutra, Attavaka, into Chinese. And therefore, the Chinese version of this sutra is available, also in very archaic Chinese, very difficult to read. This here. It also has eight paragraphs, like in the Pali canon. But it has something else. It has a long introduction in prose. And this introduction reveals to us the situation of India at the time of the Buddha, when he first attained enlightenment and began to receive young men into his Sangha as bhikshus. And the sutra that is equivalent to the Paramattha Sutra in the collection of Nghĩa Túc Kinh is called Cảnh Diện Vương Kinh. Cảnh means the mirror. The king who has a face like a mirror. In this introduction, it is said that one day many bhikshus in the early morning set out into a village, but it was a little bit too early to go into the town in order to do the arm round. And that is why they stopped in a community of another spiritual sect, and they witnessed to a discussion among many sections of the people who had gathered there. It was a lot of dispute, a lot of quarrels, and everyone claimed that he has the ultimate truth and other people are wrong. Only my teaching is authentic. Your teaching is not authentic. This is the best kind of a doctrine, and so on. There's a lot of this dispute. There's a lot of theological, philosophical speculations. and there was no peace at all. Everyone claimed to be the best. And the bhikkhus were very confused about that, very sad about that. So when they went back to the Buddha, they reported what they had seen, and the Buddha told them a Jataka story, a story of his former life. He said that, dear friends, in one of my former lives, I was a king. My name is the king with a face that looks like a mirror. And one day I gave the order to invite all the blind people in the city to come for a visit. And I ordered an elephant to be brought out, and I invite all the blind people to touch the elephant and tell me what an elephant would look like. And after having done that, one person said the elephant is like a column, because he has touched a foot of the elephant. Another said that the elephant looks like, you are wrong, the elephant does not look like a column, it looks like a fan, because he has just touched the ear of the elephant. And the other blind person said, no, an elephant does not look like a fan, it looks like a Buddha, because he has touched the back of the elephant. And another blind man said, no, an elephant does not look like a Buddha. It looks like a broom, because that person had touched the tail of the elephant. And there was a lot of discussion and quarreling. And the king laughed and laughed and laughed, said, well, what you said are wrong, because you have only seen part of the reality, and you claim that you have the true image of reality. Dear friends, you know, it is like that. If many people do not have not had access to reality, and claim to have reality, and disparage others as inferior to them because they don't get their truth. And after that, the Buddha gave the 8 paragraphs that are available to us in both Pali and Chinese. And with that background, we can understand the teaching of the sutra. And those of us who practice the 14 mindfulness trainings, we feel very close to this sutra. The first mindfulness trainings, the second and the third of the 14 mindfulness trainings are faithful expressions of this spirit of the sutra. You should not be bound to any view, to any doctrine. You should be free. And the teaching of the Buddha cannot be conceived as views, or ideologies, or doctrines, or theologies. They should be regarded as instruments for your practice. They don't worship it as the ultimate truth. The Buddha said in this sutra that when you hear something, even a Dhamma talk, when you see something, even a practice, you should not be caught by what you hear and what you see. Because what you see and what you hear might become an obstacle for your growth, so for your spiritual growth. You have to retain your freedom. Because what you see and what you hear might give you a view. And the fact is that all views are wrong views. Views prevent us from having direct access to reality. So be very careful in using your eyes. Be very careful in using your ear, your nose, your tongue, your body, and your consciousness. Do not get caught in views. That is the core of the teaching. And that is the teaching called non-attachment to views. If we have learned and practiced the 14 mindfulness trainings, you know that the first three trainings are to help us not to be attached to views, doctrines, ideologies, and that the Buddha eyes can be described, first of all, is the kind of eyes that can help us to retain our freedom. Freedom, not political freedom, freedom from views, freedom from theory, from doctrines. And therefore the Buddha bar the road of philosophical speculations. This is very authentic as far as Buddhist teaching is concerned. You should not spend your time speculating about doctrines, ideologies. What you should do is to learn the way of practice, so that you can identify your suffering, so that you can recognize your suffering. You can look deeply into the nature of your suffering and see the path leading to the cessation of suffering. And you should not indulge yourself into looking for an ideology, a doctrine, a theory. You should not indulge yourself into metaphysical speculations. And this is a very very basic in the Buddhist teaching. The Buddha said, I only teach two things. I teach about suffering and the way out of suffering. And your time should be devoted to the study and the practice of these two things. And when you are able to liberate ourselves from suffering, our mind becomes clear. And then your mind can reflect the ultimate reality without any intellectual searching. Your mind will become like a mirror. It can reflect reality as it is, without any distortion. You are a king, and your face is like a mirror, reflecting reality as it is. And you do not need any words, any concepts, any notions. He who still abides by a dogmatic view, considering it as the highest in the world, thinking this is the most excellent, and disparaging other views as inferior, is still considered not to be free from dispute. It means, my dear friends, my dear disciples, don't get into it. Make good use of your time for the practice of transformation and healing. When seeing, hearing, or sensing something and considering it as the only thing that can bring comfort and advantage to self, one is always inclined to get caught in it and rule out everything else as inferior. That is the natural tendency in every one of us. We want to detain the truth. It's a wonderful feeling that we have got the truth and others have not. And we lose our freedom. Caught in one's view and considering all other views as inferior, this attitude is considered to be by the wise as bondage, as the absence of freedom. And when you do not have freedom, your spiritual path is blocked. You cannot make any further progress. Just last week, someone wrote to Thay and said that, "Thay, I noticed that spiritual path only satisfies us for 2 or 3 years, and after that, it seems that we cannot make any progress. You are very enthusiastic during the first few years learning and practicing the spiritual path, but after a few years, you feel that you cannot advance anymore." And I understood right away. That is because what you are being offered, is a set of teachings, a set of views, and the kind of practice that are based on these views. And that is why you get caught and you cannot no longer make any progress. The only way to continue progressing on your spiritual path is to remove the obstacles made of views. Even doctrinal views, views about freedom and transformation. We have to debarrass ourselves of any views. In a sutra called the Sutra of 100 Parables, the Buddha tells the story of a young businessman who lost his son, his little boy. He was absent. He was so busy. He was not home to take care of his little boy. And during his absence, many pirates came, burned down the village, and kidnapped the kid. And when our businessman came home, he saw his house burn, just a heap of ash. He panicked. He was looking for his little boy, but he could not see anywhere. And in that state of panic, he saw the sharp body of a child. And he believed that to be the dead body of his little boy. And then he threw himself to the ground. He beat his chest. He pulled his hair. He cried. Because he was absent, that is why his little boy is dead. And after that, he organized a cremation ceremony. And he collected the ash from the body of the child, and he put it into a beautiful velvet bag, and he carried with him for all the time. Eating, sleeping, walking, he always carried the bag of ash of his so-called little boy. Because his wife was no longer there, his little boy was the only raison d'être for his life. So he was inhabited by a feeling of grief, sorrow, and he was so attached to the little bag containing the ash of his little boy. One night when he was lying without being able to sleep and crying silently, he hear the knocking at the door. It was his son who was able to escape from the pirates. And he came home and found out the need that his father had built a new house. So he knocked at the door about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And the father said, "Who's there? It's me, your son. Please open." The father said, "No. You naughty boy, my son is already dead. Who are you to come at this hour of the night and not disturb me? Go away. Or I will give you a piece of my mind." And the little boy insisted several times, but the father was so sure that his little boy was dead. And finally, the little boy has to go away. And father and son separated forever. That is a story told by the Buddha. And the Buddha said, sometime in your life, you take something to be the truth, and you are caught by it. And you are stuck. You have no chance in order to advance on your spiritual path. To go searching for the truth. And even if the truth comes and knocks at your door, you refuse to open. It's a wonderful story about attachment. We continue to suffer. And the practice of the Buddha is to release views in order to advance on your spiritual path. Suppose you have climbed a ladder, and you have arrived on the fifth step, and looking down, you see that it's great. You are very high. And you think that you have acquired the highest kind of view, the most beautiful view you can get. And then if you are caught in the situation, you would not like to make another step, because it is always possible to make another step. It is like science. Scientists have discovered things and consider them to be the truth. And if they are attached to that, if they think of that as the absolute truth, they will stop, inquire. They inquire, and they cannot advance. So good scientists are the scientists who are ready to abandon the views. Because they are open-minded, they are free. And the spirit of science is the spirit of openness. A good scientist is always ready to let go of his or her findings in order to make another step into on the path of free inquiry. So the practice of non-attachment to views is a very basic in the teaching of the Buddha. And each one of us has to use our Buddha eyes in order to practice it, to free ourselves from views. Happy is the person who is free from views, including your views on happiness. There is a country who believe that only that ideology alone can help the country to be strong and people to be happy. And they embrace that ideology for 70 years. And during that time, they persecuted a lot of people who do not agree with them. They put them in prisons, in psychiatric hospitals, because they had the courage to challenge them about their views. It created a lot of suffering, of death, of separation, of frustration, because you are too much attached to a view, a super ideology. You can hold on to a view like that for as long as 70 years, but 70 years is a lot. It can create a lot of suffering to you and to the people you love. Your goodwill is there, but you do not have freedom. Each of us may be still imprisoned by our view concerning our happiness. We believe we can only be happy with these conditions, A, B, C, D. So according to this teaching, it's very helpful to go back and to take a look on our view concerning our own happiness. Maybe it is likely that your view of happiness is the main obstacle for you to be happy. If you have 1 hour, 2 hours to practice, please go and sit at the foot of the plum tree and look into your idea concerning your happiness. You have believed firmly that if you don't get this or that, happiness will not be possible. It may be that if you abandon that view of happiness, and then happiness can come to you right here and right now. Because conditions for happiness are always there. It is only because you got you imprison yourself in a view that happiness has never been possible to you. According to the Buddha, to live happily in the here and the now is possible for everyone. You need only one thing, to be free from your views. It's not other people are imposing something on you so that you cannot be free. It is you who imprison yourself in your views. That is why the basic practice of Buddhism is the practice of removing all the views. Nirvana. Is the absence, is the silencing of all views. Because views and notions are the foundation of suffering. When you are able to silence all views and words, when you get free from views and words, reality in itself will reveal to you, and that is Nirvana. Nirvana is cessation, is the extinction. First, the extinction of views, and then the extinction of the suffering that are born from these views. Yeah. Very aware, we are very concerned about our well-being and the well-being of our beloved ones. We want us to be happy, we want our children, our partner, our friends to be happy. You don't have any doubt about that kind of goodwill. But we are not free. We think our son can only be happy if he does this. If he does not do that, our daughter can be happy only if she does this, and she did not do that. So we impose our views on our beloved one and destroy them, because our goodwill to love is to offer freedom, to offer the conditions for the other person to be free, to get the right understanding about his or her happiness. One day the Buddha was sitting in the wood near the city of Shravasti. He had finished his lunch, and surrounding him there was a group of monks. And suddenly a farmer went by. The farmer looked very unhappy. The farmer asked, "Monks, have you seen my cows going by this way?" And the Buddha said, "No, we have not seen any cows. You have to go and look for the other direction." The farmer said, "Monks, I suffer so much. I think I am going to kill myself. I only have 12 cows, and I don't know why this morning they have left me and run away. I have 2 acres of sesame seed plants, and this year the insect ate them all. I suffer so much. I think I am going to kill myself. Out of compassion, the Buddha said, my dear friend, you have not seen your cows passing by this way, so please try, look in that other direction. And after the farmer was gone, the Buddha turned back to his monks and smiled and said, you, my friend, you are the luckiest people on earth. You don't have any cows to lose. Our cows might be our business, our enterprise. Our cows might be the other person, our hope, our desire. Our cows may be our ideas, our notions as how to be happy. The happiest person is the person who is free from cows. It's the person who is capable of releasing cows. So I would like to suggest this each of us have some time to practice looking deeply into our view, our notion of our own happiness, our own practice. If we are not happy yet, if we are still struggling for happiness, if we are not capable of establishing ourselves in the here and the now and enjoy every minute of our daily life, it may be because we still entertain a view concerning our own happiness. Our purpose of coming to the retreat is not to acquire more views, more ideas concerning the Dharma. Maybe we think that we need to bring something home after the retreat. But the best way is not to bring anything home. The best way is to leave everything here and to come home as a free person. So the teaching and the practice aims at only at one thing, help you to release all your cows inside of you, and you come home as a free person. Whether you are a therapist, you are a therapist, a scientist, a householder, a parent, a teacher, it's very important for you to release all your cows and become a free person. When you go home with that freedom, you'll be the best therapist, you'll be the best educator. It's not our practice to gather more ideas and notions, even ideas and notions concerning Buddhism. To learn a number of things in order to go home and apply to our profession and so on. It is said here very clearly that concerning three things, you have to be careful. First of all, doctrines. Second, the rules. Even if the rule is presented as in the form of mindfulness trainings, and the rites, the rituals, you have to be free from all three. Let us reiterate. Let us listen to the third paragraph. Caught in one's view and considering all other views as inferior, this attitude is considered by the wise as a bondage, as the absence of freedom. A good practitioner never hastily believes in what is seen, heard, and sensed, including rules and rites. It is very clear. You see something, you have seen something, you hear something, you get caught. And that something is what? That something is the teaching, the doctrine. That something is the rule. And that something is the ritual. And the basic teaching of the Buddha is not to get caught in the teachings. Even the teaching of impermanence, the teaching of no self, the teaching of nirvana. Not to get caught in rules, even the mindfulness trainings. Not to get caught in rituals, like a chanting, bowing. You can bow as a free person, or you can bow as a slave because you get caught in the rituals. And the Buddha advised us not to get caught in rituals. Not to get caught in rules. Because mindfulness trainings are there not to deprive you of your freedom. If you receive the mindfulness trainings having the impression that you have lost your freedom, and then mindfulness trainings become an obstacle for your evolution, for your happiness. And if you receive teaching and think that this teaching is what I have to die for, to fight for a survival, sacrificing myself and the life of other people, you get caught in the teaching and you lose your freedom. So freedom is at the foundation of the Buddhist teaching and practice.